It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Kirk.
Happy Saturday.
Happy Saturday to you, too, as well. Not a happy Saturday to Judge Joe Brown. You remember this guy?
Yes. Good old Judge Joe Brown.
Judge Joe Brown. His show was canceled, I believe, about a year ago, but he got himself into some hot water. According to CNN, TV judges Joe Brown was jailed on a contempt of court charge issued by a Tennessee juvenile judge.
Not a judge who's a juvenile.
No, right.
Like
exactly.
Doogie Howser, J.D.
No, it wasn't a Doogie Howser judge. But Brown is 66 years old, and he was sentenced to 5 days in jail after he became, quote, pretty raucous, end quote, and challenged the authority of Magistrate Judge Harold Horn, another judge told CNN. He was later released on his own recognizance. Brown, a former Shelby County criminal judge, he is actually a former real judge, not just
like
the
most
TV
of the TV
judge.
Judges are used to be judges now.
Right.
They're just kind of
exactly
TV judges.
But he was in court to represent a child in a child support case, and he apparently became upset when he was told the case was not on the afternoon docket. Horn, who is, quote, a real laid-back guy, according to sources. That's the judge. Gave Brown several chances to calm down before finding him in contempt. Horn held Brown in contempt 5 times before they were able to get him out of the courtroom. The court staff and judges were all kind of floored by Brown's behavior. And Brown was booked into the Shelby County Jail in Memphis Monday afternoon. Brown presided over a syndicated reality TV show based on a court case arbitration for 15 years until it was canceled last year. Now, he also has announced his candidacy for the Shelby County District Attorney post last month. So I don't know if this will help him or hurt him.
Did you hear the recording? They had the recording online of the actual interview.
Oh, no, I haven't heard that recording.
It was very interesting, to say the least.
Was it raucous?
Because the judge was being very laid back, very polite, and just saying, well, you know, we're going to have to move on. It's not on the docket. I apologize. And Judge Joe just starts going off on the guy and starts raising all these strange jurisdictional questions, and you don't have authority to do this and that, and then sort of shouting over him and that kind of thing. And I don't know. I mean, maybe you can just chalk it up to a bad day.
It was a bad day. Yeah. And he, his mugshot picture that they had, it didn't look good. I've never seen a mugshot that looks
good. We're used to seeing him with the makeup on and the all that stuff.
The mustache is kind of out of place. It doesn't look good.
Maybe that's what it was. You just didn't get the mustache correctly affixed.
I think it's a real mustache, but I'm not sure. All right, so the Wisconsin Assembly has approved more money for a man who was wrongfully convicted of homicide, Robert Lee Stinson. We talked about this gentleman a while back on the show. He was convicted in 1985 of killing a Milwaukee woman, and the judge freed him in 2009 after the Wisconsin Innocence Project argued that the bite mark analysis and the DNA evidence didn't match evidence from the scene. Stinson was asking for $129,000 in compensation, which is a pittance compared to how long he was in. The state claims board awarded him $25,000, the maximum allowed under state law in 2010, but recommended the state give him another $90,000. Republicans and Democrats introduced a bill in August that would give Stinson the extra money, according to the Associated Press. The Senate passed the measure in November, but amended it to give Stinson $136,000. They passed the $90,000 version of the bill this last Tuesday. This is something we've talked about.
You know what's wrong with all this, though, is that he's not the only guy who spent time in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And why on earth they see it fit to pass legislation that affects one particular guy is beyond me. Because if it's a problem that's systemic, the right thing to do is to raise the compensation limit for anyone who's in that situation, not just this guy. So it's like trying to fix a broken car engine with bubble gum or something. I mean, if it is recognizing the fact that we have this issue in our system, and unfortunately, when it comes down to how do you repair an error like this, things do come down to dollars and cents, because you can't give someone years of their life back. You can't add on an extra 10 years or so at the end of their life.
And sometimes money is the only thing that we can give somebody, because you're right. We can't give them their lives back. So what is it worth for Mr. Stinson not to see his family? What is it worth for him not to have his freedom for even one day? What is that worth? Much less years of his life being spent behind bars, knowing that he did not commit this crime, that he was innocent of this offense. I mean,
you know, I'll tell you where you could get the money. You know, if we're worried about taxpayers paying the money and taxpayers being involved with, you know, where is this money supposed to come from on a tight budget and all these other things? Well, think about who is responsible for putting him there and not investigating the case well enough and for vigorously prosecuting somebody who, you know, our system is supposed to protect that presumption of innocence and make sure that people that are innocent of a crime don't end up haphazardly being convicted. So there was a salary of a prosecutor and a salary of a judge that taxpayer dollars paid way back then. And those things were not interrupted over the course of the years that he was in prison. So, you know, there's a source right there for some money. How about people involved in the process? You know, it would work that way in an intentional tort situation. Let's say you and I were involved in some scenario where I deliberately confined you in my basement for 10 years, and you lost your job, you lost your family, you lost all these other things. And I'm not the state of Wisconsin, I'm just Kirk. And, you know, I've got you in my dungeon, and you're wearing the GIMP mask and all those other things. You can tell I've thought about this, right?
You've thought about this way too much.
But, you know, who would be financially on the hook for damages?
Well, you would.
And it would be more than just the money that you lost out of pocket. It would be emotional damages. It would be all the scarring, the emotional scarring that would go on for years and years and years, and the anger and the anguish and all of these things, and you know, it can add up to quite a bit, quite
well,
a bit.
You think about it,
and that's what stops me from doing it. I mean, I have the basement all ready to go.
I'm not
going to do it because of the financial risk. You see.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, you know, you imagine, though, I mean, the worst possible thing you can come up with, aside from being put to death, or in some cases would argue worse than being put to death, would be being confined against your will for something that you did not do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think
and
about
every day that.
That
you try and say, look, I'm not supposed to be here, and then all the prison guards are like, yeah, right. Sure.
That's what everybody says.
That's what they all say. Yeah. And then you're treated as you're being punished. You're being corrected in the correctional system for something you didn't do. That makes a whole lot of sense.
Well,
right?
what would the appropriate amount? I mean, they've set this arbitrary amount or had previously set this arbitrary amount at $25,000 per year. What would be the appropriate amount? $1 million a year?
Well, why don't they have some system where, because, you know, the lottery, that's run by the state too.
Right.
You know, they could just advance him a winning lottery ticket, you know, for an upcoming lottery.
Well, there you go. Maybe that would. But I mean, seriously, what would be the appropriate amount? Would it be $500,000 a year?
Well, I think there should be no cap. Why is there a cap at all?
But how do you determine the amount? That's the question. How do you determine the amount?
There is no way. There is, I mean, and for because it's, well, you know, depending on your views of how life works and how the world works. I mean, there is the view that, you know, stuff happens, right? You know,
right.
Forrest Gump said it a different way, but stuff happens, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes people are just the victim of circumstance, the victim of bad luck. And sometimes people die as a result of that. And if you go back 100 years where life was, you know, so much more uncontrollable, you know, you could be hit by a Model T Ford, you know, and people just didn't really have much recourse. You could die of influenza or something like that. That's one side of the argument. The other one is every day, every second, every minute of life is priceless.
Well, is this something where a jury ought to decide this type of a thing?
Absolutely.
I mean, really, when we think about it, you know, in the civil context, when somebody dies as a result of negligence or whatever the case may be of another, let's say a company, right? Let's say that somebody has something and they put together a structure wrongfully and a piece of concrete slab falls on a child and the child dies. I mean,
In a Milwaukee parking garage, for example.
In a Milwaukee parking garage, for example. Let's imagine that. And let's imagine what a jury has to decide. So they have to decide how much money to reimburse the person. And you know, plaintiff's lawyers sometimes get a bad rap, I think unfairly so, because they have to go in and they can't bring this child back. They can't possibly bring the child back. They have to find out what amount of money would be appropriate to compensate, to punish, essentially, whatever, you know.
And it's not only that. I mean, in the concept of the civil law arena, which you and I don't practice in, but of course we're educated somewhat on how those things work. The idea is that sometimes money is the only thing that can make a person what whole. We call whole,
right.
Which is impossible in that type of scenario. But, you know, there's another thing. We always talk on the show about how our criminal laws serve both as a way to punish and regulate society, but also to deter people from doing things that they shouldn't be doing.
Yes.
And that is recognized as a legitimate purpose of civil liability as well. And I think the reason that we don't have a civil procedure or civil lawsuits where a prisoner could, you know, legitimately sue the state is this concept of sovereign immunity. Those two words, we all know what immunity means, but sovereign, of course, means the king or the crown. And in this context, it means the government. So the government can't be sued for wrongs of the government unless there's a specific waiver by the government of sovereign immunity. So the government has to say somewhere in some legislation that, okay, it's all right, you can sue me, I don't mind. And it has to be a waiver of that. Sometimes there's a limited waiver of sovereign immunity. But in a context like this, think about it. How many people in the process could end up getting sued as part of their individual duties, plus the fact that they're working for a government entity, which in and of itself is responsible for making sure that these things don't happen?
Lots and lots of people.
And doesn't it bother you that we live in a society where these things do happen?
It does.
It bothers me.
It does. Well, we have to take a break. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk. Hey, Casey, you know what Monday is?
What is Monday?
Monday is opening day of the Brewers baseball season.
Oh, boy. Are you going to be there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, Kirk's going to be there, so he's going to bring down the house. I know. I'm very excited about that. It's going to be interesting to see how Ryan Braun is welcomed back. And this just sort of popped into my mind.
Have you seen any of the spring training games?
I've seen a couple of them.
He's welcomed in a sense,
yeah.
With lots of boos and things like that. Not so much from the Milwaukee Brewers fans, but every other team they're playing against, they give a nice hearty boo for him to come to the plate.
Do you think Brewers fans at Miller Park on opening day will welcome him back with open arms?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
So the forgiveness is there, you think?
Well, yeah. And not only that, but, you know, this is one of those situations where he admitted to his mistakes. He's an excellent baseball player, with or without testosterone enhancement or whatever was going on. And frankly, you know, the harm that was done by lying to the public. And if you go back to some of our archive shows, I'm sure you'll remember me vigorously defending the idea that Ryan Braun has got to be innocent of these charges because I just can't picture him, you know, having it within him to lie to people because he's such a good guy.
Well, he fooled all of us.
And I was wrong.
He fooled all of us.
Yeah.
And you know, the biggest part for me, though, was, remember when we talked about a while back, was his apology really an apology? Or was it just a non-apology apology?
Well,
was it something where he was truly remorseful and sincere? Because that's really what you want to hear.
Yeah, and I will admit that his public statement was not as specific as some people would like. But the process of working out how long his suspension would be reflects his remorse to the baseball, you know, commission, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know who's in charge of that kind of thing. You know?
Right.
Bud Selig, I don't know. But to the process of, you know, him expressing the appropriate amount of remorse and acceptance of responsibility goes to that governing body, and obviously they felt that a suspension for the remainder of the season was good enough.
Well, there was a mishandling of the urine sample. Well,
right, and that's true. Beginning. That's true.
And that did happen, but then it came out later through testing that we...
Well, not only that, but his name appeared on a list of people that were certainly at least seeking consultation with the individual who was prepared to provide performance-enhancing drugs.
So it looks really bad, and I heard an analysis of this that somebody was talking about the other day in the newspaper, and they were talking about essentially how perhaps this these performance enhancing drugs could have accounted for, you know, 40% of his home runs.
Well, wait. Let's back up. What really happened here is that he had an elevated testosterone level. he was not taking steroids. He wasn't pumping up on steroids.
It's called a performance-enhancing drug for a reason.
No. He had a prohibited substance. He had a substance in his system that's prohibited by baseball. That doesn't mean it actually did anything to help him, okay? And let's be clear on this, because there's a very long list of things that you're not supposed to have in your system, but not all of them actually make you hit home runs.
Well, no, I'm not saying they all make you like home runs, but he took them for a reason.
He's not juicing.
Performance.
No, actually, there is a debate about that.
Because, about whether he took them for a reason?
Yes, there
What's
is.
What's the debate on that?
What I've heard is that he had an injury that he was seeking to – it was a groin injury, I believe, that he was seeking to recover from more quickly. And you might say that's performance enhancing, but there was a particular medication that in and of itself is not a steroid, is not a performance enhancing drug, but it does contain something that helps your testosterone levels increase. That's it, okay? And it's not like he was juicing. It's not like he was doing it for a long time. I mean, there's no evidence of that anyway.
The bottom line, though, is that...
He took some form of medication he shouldn't have taken because it was prohibited.
But this does sully the name of baseball and Major League Baseball in general, because when you have people who are taking these, you have others who aren't taking these. And I know the argument is, well, everybody takes performance-enhancing drugs. That's not true. Everybody doesn't take performance-enhancing drugs, and we do have the testing to show that. So for the people who don't take them and who legitimately try to get into a profession to help them, that's cheating. It's just cheating. And you can't excuse that.
And I'm not. I'm just indicating that in this particular situation, we're not talking about somebody who spent 8 or 9 or 10 years shooting steroids, on the sly to build up body mass. And look at Ryan Braun. He's not a big dude. I mean, he really isn't. He's just a talented baseball player. So, you might wonder, okay, well, how do people end up in a situation where they're tempted to do this sort of thing because of the competition involved? Well, let's not forget, there's millions of dollars at stake, and maybe that's a bad thing in and of itself. We could go on and on and on about that, whether or not it warrants the payment of, multi-million dollar salaries.
Well, players ought to be able to get paid.
Oh, of course. Absolutely.
And if they're in a situation where, they're only viable in terms of their careers last, 10, 12, maybe 15 years at the most. I mean, that's a long career.
I'm going to be a little facetious here, but on purpose.
Yeah.
But just to make a point, because I have always wondered. I understand the idea of like artificially increasing your capacity to perform better and that being an unfair advantage. But what about Tommy John surgery? What about that? People get that. It's not necessary, medically necessary, but it makes people better pitchers.
So what's the difference between that and taking a performance?
Well, I'm saying it's a similar thing. It's something that improves the overall structure of the muscle in your body surgically. What if somebody wanted to make themselves, you'd find a way for them to have leg transplants where they have legs that are 3 feet taller and in baseball, basketball or something, they're faster and those kinds of things. What about Oscar Pistorius having artificial legs and being able to run faster?
That was a controversy.
That was a controversy, wasn't it?
Right.
But what I'm saying is there are things that we all do to enhance our performance, and some of them are artificial. It's something as simple as Gatorade. I mean, that doesn't have any prohibited substances in it, but it's got more than water, right? What if the fact that you eat lots of bananas and increase your potassium level, and you eat good food, and you don't eat steaks? Maybe we should require baseball players to eat like a couple of steaks every day.
So if you're arguing that bananas are a PED, then
not all of these performance-enhancing drugs are necessarily, things that enhance performance in the way that we think of them.
Right.
And I based on at least the research I've done, and of course we don't know the whole story, but this was something that was more of a technical violation. I'm sure it's more than that. I'm sure I'm just saying that because I like Ryan Braun, but,
So are you arguing then that anything goes sort of in this context? I mean, if we're going to make this a performance-enhancing drug, then we ought to make things like bananas and Gatorade.
I'm just saying it's an interesting and difficult process. Where do you draw the line? Because we all do things to make our performance better. The more you work out, the better athlete you're going
to
be.
But that's just the point that people want to get back to, I think. Is
the more you practice.
Working out and practicing, that just takes hard work. That's something that you do and that you can do to naturally improve your performance, as opposed to just sitting back and taking a drug that artificially improves your performance. It's like, you know, it's good old-fashioned hard work versus the days of, you know, injecting people with certain drugs that make them... I mean, it's the whole Lance Armstrong theory. It's the whole Barry Bonds theory.
Well, and then, you know, and then people draw this analogy like, oh, Ryan Braun did what Lance Armstrong did. No. Lance Armstrong had a conspiracy of silence that ran like the mafia. I mean, that's a totally different thing.
Well, I think the worst thing that Ryan Braun did in all of this, to be quite honest, aside from taking the performance-enhancing drugs, I would put the second, selling the reputation of the guy who he was attacking. I mean, just so...
Well,
just
that and lying to the fans.
And then lying to the fans, yeah. That was the worst. But he was getting on the phone with fans last year, right at the end of last year, and he was getting on the phone with real fans and talking to them and saying, you know, forgive me, I'm Ryan Braun, and please forgive me for this. At some point, he does deserve... This is akin to, it could be analogized to, somebody serving out a sentence, like Michael Vick, who did something much worse in the sense of, you know, basically involving dogs dying and things like that, running a horrible dog operation. He went to prison, served out his prison sentence. He's now on the free market in terms of being a free agent, and he served his time.
Not only that, but, you know, one might say, and I think this would not necessarily be inaccurate, he's been welcomed back with open arms to some extent.
By some.
A lot of people say, hey, you know, he's done his time, he served his sentence, he's, you know, he's corrected. Yeah. Fire correctional system.
Well, and this is the type of person that we want back in society because he has served his time. He has truly apologized. He has not committed any crimes. He's still, I believe he's still under probation, so any screw up he makes is to send him back into prison.
Sure, and as I've said all along, it's so unfortunate because he's got natural talent that requires no enhancement. I mean, it's just clear.
He's got true natural talent.
And of course, when you're on the other team, let's say you're a, I don't know, a Cubs fan or, I don't know, something like that. And, you know, no offense to Charlie, our investigator, who is a big Cubs fan. But you know, I know he's listening now because he religiously listens to our show. But let's say you're a Cubs fan. It's easy to say, boo, Ryan Braun, because he's on the other team.
Right.
I mean, isn't that just what people do when they have a chance? That's just what they do.
I'll tell you what I'm looking forward to. Sheer natural raw talent, the Wisconsin Badgers basketball game tonight. Oh, looking forward to that. That's going to be wonderful. And they played very well in the Elite Eight, and I can guarantee – well, I can't guarantee you, but I'll bet you no performance-enhancing drugs there, just sheer raw talent.
I'm sure you watched the game like everybody else did against Baylor.
Yes.
That was
– an amazing game.
Yeah, and not only because of the fact that they completely dominated Baylor, but they played well and played coordinated, and they were like a well-oiled machine.
Their passing game was tremendous. We will it'll be interesting to listen to that game.
We don't eat our words tonight. Don't want to jinx it. Knock on wood.
All right, we'll be back with Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey in just a moment.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
She's a good girl, loves her mama, loves Jesus in America too. She's a good girl, is crazy about Elvis, loves horses and her boyfriend too.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear.
All right, Kirk, you are originally from New York.
Yes.
And so this is a topic that is probably near and dear to your heart. These base jumpers who leapt off of the Freedom Tower, or the World Trade Center, Freedom Tower, I guess you call it.
World Trade Center 1.
World Trade Center 1. These daredevils, according to ABC News, accused of parachuting off the top of World Trade Center 1, along with an alleged accomplice, turned themselves in Monday and then released video of the stunt on YouTube. They released it themselves. James Brady, 32, Andrew Rossig, 33, Marco Markovic, 27, and Kyle Hartwell, 29. They're all accused of jumping off. Well, actually, one is the ground person, and there's sort of a scheme here. They're charged with felony burglary, misdemeanor reckless endangerment, and a misdemeanor jumping from a structure. They actually have that
right
in New York, probably sure. because there's so many big buildings. They now face up to 7 years in prison. And if you watch this video, you could see it online. It was fascinating.
Oh, yeah. I've seen it.
And, of course, not to encourage anybody to do this, because I don't think it's a good thing. But
well, not only that, I can't imagine that someone would have the courage to
courage
do it.
To do it. But, you know. Yeah, 7 years in prison. They were wearing one of these helmet cams.
Well, they're facing 7 years in prison, right? They
facing,
haven't been set.
Facing. Yeah. No, they haven't been. One of them said, everybody has their thing. This is our thing. We were thinking that very clearly that everything was working out for us to make a clean, safe jump. And they did make a pretty clean, safe jump. We found a spot where the cameras were not picking up, and there happened to be a hole in the fence as well. So if you can imagine this, they go up. It's the middle of the night. There's, the only thing that's lit are all the buildings. But, of course, there's no natural light out. And they jump off of this building. And I was thinking to myself, as one of them was jumping off, parachuting off, you know, he's landing in the middle of the street. I don't know what street that was, but it was in the middle of Manhattan, right?
Yeah.
And there were really no cars.
It looked like it was one of the main avenues, like it might have been Fifth Avenue, Fourth Avenue, something like that.
Yeah. And he quickly jumps. He comes down and he takes his parachute and he runs into like some bush and hides the parachute. And they didn't catch him.
Yeah, and this was a while ago, right? Wasn't this last year?
Yeah, this was a while ago. Right, it was. And how they got up there, right, in what is supposed to be the most secure building.
Well, it's not secure yet because it's not done.
It's not done.
Being back then.
But it was still supposed to be secure. I mean, they had cameras and they found some place.
And this is what occurred to me that, okay, it makes sense that we have laws that you can't go jumping off buildings.
Right.
And it's probably most applicable to people who jump off buildings and don't die. Because, you know, if someone's, you see those pictures of people that threw themselves off the Empire State Building and they smash a car into the ground. And the cop's not usually there writing them a ticket for doing that. It's usually people that do it and survive. And it makes sense because you don't want to have people jumping off buildings all over the place because it's a safety issue.
Right, of course not.
It creates hazards to not only themselves but also people on the ground and all these other things. And I get that part of it. But when I heard this story, it occurred to me that this appears to be a bit of a political statement.
Absolutely.
In the sense that, guess what? Guess what we were able to do? Guess how lax the security is in what should be the most secure location in New York City? And by golly, they did it and proved it.
And is that what maybe certainly provoked this story to be to get more legs than it otherwise would have? Because
I think it's going to get a lot of legs just because jumping off the tallest structure in New York
City.
Yeah,
but isn't there an embarrassment factor here? I mean, for the people who are supposed to protect the building,
which is kind of political speech in a way.
And the irony of jumping off the Freedom Tower and then losing your freedom as a result of doing that. I mean, really, that's the whole thing. And they did this. There was some implication that perhaps they did this to show,
to point out the weakness.
Well, to point out the weakness. But also to show that, well, they don't really have the freedom to do that because it's against the law. But they were doing something that was sort of free-spirited. They jumped off this building. They survived. They did it. And now they're being turned in. And they're the ones who turned over the video themselves. So, you know, and they turned themselves.
It's interesting because we do have situations. We've seen situations all through history where people have broken a law in order to enhance the message, and in this case, perhaps a political message that, look, the city is not doing enough to protect the security of this, and maybe doing a public service in that process by saying, look, you know, we're thinking that this is going to be impenetrable. This is going to be the place that cannot be attacked by anyone or infiltrated by anyone. But guess what? We just did. And we wanted to show you that it needs
to be. And we as lawyers obviously would never encourage anybody to break the law. It reminds me, however, of the the people who try to get through airport security, and they would do things intentionally. You know, try to bring things in intentionally to get through airport security.
Well, those are usually undercover government agents that are doing that.
But there were some that weren't, There were some that were just citizens, and they were trying to get things in, and then they got arrested.
Which
and
is a bad idea.
It's a bad idea. I think right. It is a bad idea.
Overall.
But they were showing...
Because then what happens if you end up on the plane and you've got a gun or something?
Yeah. Then
like,
you're,
whoops.
You're facing some pretty serious federal charges.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you're going to... The plane is going to land, and you're going to be taken off in handcuffs and probably taken into a detention facility. And
right. Or if you do... what's the Words with Friends or whatever the game
yes.
is. If you're doing that and you happen to be Alec Baldwin and
don't
know.
Play Words with Friends.
Yeah,
that's not,
on the plane.
On the plane, at least.
Right.
I mean, you don't want to do that, or Candy Crush or any of these other games.
Yeah,
that
Candy
people are
I just learned what that was the other day, and apparently I'm the only person left in America that has never heard of that.
I've heard of it, but don't feel bad because I wouldn't know how to play it. My wife plays it, but I
something to do with candy that. And crushing.
Yeah, I can't get it. To me, it seems like a waste of time, but. You know, whatever. Who am I? The trial of Oscar Pistorius was postponed due to the illness of one of the two assessors. The assessors are people, unlike in our justice system, who help the judge decide the verdict. South Africa does not have jury trials. There's been an effort to get South Africa to have jury trials. But Oscar Pistorius, this is just such a weird case. Blade Runner, as people are calling him. And this is the guy who there's no question that he killed his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp. But the question is whether he did it intentionally, whether it was a mistake, whether he thought there was an intruder there or not. And there's been a lot of evidence in this case. Nancy Grace, your favorite, Kirk, has been on television. She was arguing with Dan Abrams. She's been on a rampage because she found out, and this is really not new news, but she found out that apparently on the day of the killing that Oscar Pistorius was looking at pornography. And what relevance...
Whoa!
What
no
relevance,
way!
What relevance that has to this case, I have no idea. But she seems to be on a rampage saying that it was just terrible. I mean, it's really a character assassination is what she's trying to do. She's trying to say, well, because he was looking at pornography, well, then he must be guilty of murder, right? I mean, like, that makes sense. So
only Nancy Grace could draw that connection.
Only she would draw that connection. And there's also this whole debate about this Oscar Pistorius trial because... The prosecution had to concede that he was not wearing his prosthetic limbs when he was behind the bathroom door, by the way, and fired several shots through the door. Now, ballistics is extremely important in this case because whether he fired a couple of rounds or not, and whether he fired them in quick succession is at issue because one of the ballistics experts believes that the shot was fired and first hit Reva Steenkamp, I believe, in the shoulder. And then there's testimony from neighbors who say that they heard screams from her. Now, the defense says that the screams, in fact, were from Oscar Pistorius after he realized that he had shot Reva Steenkamp. So that's in dispute. But what's going, I think, well for the defense in this case is that the trajectory of the bullets and the fact that he fired behind the bathroom door, to me, are two points that suggest, because the trajectory of the bullets went upward, suggest that perhaps this was in self-defense. Now, I'm not saying it was, but it could be argued that.
Or a blend of self-defense
and fear
right. of the unknown and that sort of thing, and a mistake.
Right.
A mistake.
Right, because if he was going to kill her in cold blood, wouldn't the most obvious explanation...
Why would you do it through a door?
Why would you do it through a door?
When you're on the... He was on the inside of the bathroom.
He was on the inside.
Was he... In the bathtub?
No, he had gone out to his balcony, apparently, to get a fan.
Oh.
Like, you know, like a fan.
Yeah.
And then he came back in, and when he came back in, he had heard these noises and thought that there was an intruder. At least that's the story that they're telling. Now, others will say, the prosecution will say, well, okay, if he was so worried about intruders coming in, and apparently this wasn't the first time he'd been worried about this, why would he then leave his balcony door open? Wide open if he was so worried about that. Why would he not have the door locked? That's another question that the prosecution is raising in this case.
Well, has there been any evidence introduced of motive or any kind of problems or any kind of
The only thing
spat?
I can see is that the prosecution is painting him as a hothead. They've introduced some testimony from a former girlfriend of Oscar Pistorius who says essentially that well, this kind of thing happened with her.
He shot me through the door of a bathroom.
Well, no. He didn't kill her, but he quickly got up one night because he thought that there was an intruder in his house. Now, to me, that could support the defense argument
True.
That this is how he reacts when he thinks that there's an intruder.
Well, and I honestly have no idea how it works under South African law, but in the United States, the fact that somebody is has a character trait for overreacting to potential threats probably isn't a good thing. And in fact, the standard that's employed when trying to determine if somebody acted reasonably or not is a reasonable person
standard,
and not the actual individual person, because obviously if it was the individual person having a unique character trait that results in people dying, that's not necessarily, you know,
right,
the standard we want to use.
Right. All right. Well, we do have to take a break. We'll be back with the final segment. Remember, you're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
I like guns. I like the way they look. I like the shiny steel and the polished wood. I don't care if they're big or small. They're for sale. Hell, I want them all. I like guns. I like guns. I like guns.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
All right, Kirk. The Supreme Court issued a ruling this week. And this, according to USA Today, the Supreme Court ruled Wednesday that a federal law intended to keep guns away from domestic violence offenders can apply even if their crime was nothing more than, quote, offensive touching. The decision was a victory for gun control advocates and groups that work to protect battered spouses and children, and a defeat for gun rights organizations that argued the federal law goes too far. For the justices, it came down to the proper definition of physical force, one that a majority of them decided did not have to be violent or even directly applied to the victim by the abuser. Routine battery convictions, the court said, are sufficient to trigger the ban. We see no anomaly in grouping domestic abusers convicted of generic assault or battery offenses together with others whom the federal law disqualifies from gun ownership. This law was challenged by James Alvin Castleman of Tennessee, who pleaded guilty to injuring the mother of his child in 2001 and who was indicted on gun charges 7 years later. He sought to dismiss the gun charges, contending that his original crime did not involve physical force. The problem for the justices is that many states do not differentiate between actual violence and other actions that cause injury. The federal law relies on definitions within state laws, but in 28 states and the District of Columbia, assault and battery statutes include provisions for mere touching. And Scalia actually concurred in this opinion. But he ridiculed the court's inclusion of offensive touching as a crime triggering the gun ban. Under the definitions of domestic violence used by public interest groups, he said, that could sweep up acts of omission, repeated accusations of infidelity, and name-calling. When they and the court impose their all-embracing definition on the rest of us, they not only distort the law, they impoverish the language, Scalia wrote. When everything is domestic violence, nothing is. That was Scalia's quote.
Well, and he makes a good point here, because this is an area of law where we know what the legislative intent is, and that is that in a general sense, and I know I'm overgeneralizing here, so we're not really talking about any specific case, but the idea is that if we have a category of people that are allowed by law to possess firearms, as we all are, we start with that presumption that you may possess a firearm. Then there's all kinds of layers of things on top of that that modify that in some ways. And you may or may not agree with how it's regulated, how you have to fill out the right paperwork, how you have to have things monitored, how you have to, in most cases, in most states, either have a permit or have some sort of application process. There's the cooling off period that you have to comply with ATF forms. There are differences between whether you're buying it as at a gun show or a gun shop, and all these other things that create a lot of regulation in the process. But backing up to this other concept, which is our federal laws make certain categories of people what we call prohibited persons. And they're people that, because of either a conviction or a particular aspect of that person, we deem them to be ineligible to possess a firearm. Now, that's where it deviates from the regulatory process somewhat, because we don't simply count on the regulations to prohibit those people. We put people on notice, generally speaking, under the law, that they're not allowed to. The biggest category of controversy that comes up in this area is what we call a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, because we all know, and it's very well known, that when someone is a convicted felon, they forfeit that right to possess a firearm because of that felony conviction, which in and of itself is kind of silly, because what relationship is there between a felony and whether or not someone can safely possess a firearm? Say, for example, an issue that we see all the time, the kid that just turned 17 that has a girlfriend that is about to turn 16, and he is a felon because he has a relationship with her that a lot of people have or have had, and it's kind of, you know, we talked about this on the show last week.
Or let's say the person who possesses a gram of marijuana and has a prior conviction
right.
for possession of marijuana, making this one a felony conviction.
Or better yet, all the myriad of financial-oriented crimes that are based on negligence and not intentional conduct. You know, and there are many people in our country that are convicted felons that did nothing intentional and by accident became felons. How does that protect society? Well, taking it a step further, if we're going to say, okay, you don't actually have to be a full-blown convicted felon for you to be a prohibited person, you can also be somebody with a lower-level conviction that qualifies as quote-unquote domestic violence. Now, that sounds like we know what that means. You know, you beat up your girlfriend, your wife beats you up. And because of the fact that this is the type of person that we're going to categorize as one who cannot keep their anger under control, and the next step, if the violence escalates, is it turns into someone getting shot. Okay, well, good idea. That makes sense. If we're going to say, look, if you are to the point where you're actually getting convicted of something that rises to the level of you are not able to keep your cool when dealing with your wife, girlfriend, boyfriend, husband, or it could be son or daughter or anybody that you have a domestic relationship with.
Right.
That we don't want guns to be part of that scenario. Okay? Makes sense. You know, in my mind, it's a little overreaching there, because there are so many situations. But this case borders on the absurd, because now we're talking about not what we think of. We're not talking about the scenario that makes sense anymore. We're not talking about somebody who engages in actual violence, as we think of that term being used. We're talking about. And here's the other thing. Do we live in a world where we're going to pretend that part of any domestic relationship doesn't include disagreements? I mean, part of life is disagreement. You know, in fact, if you watch the presidential or any other sort of political debate, these people are disagreeing with each other. In fact, sometimes they're launching attacks at each other.
Well, and you understand where this came from, which is that, you know, we don't want violent people who have been convicted of crimes necessarily owning guns. But you're right. It depends on the context, and it depends on a whole bunch of other things, as you point out, Kirk. And we've gotten to this point where I think it's become too broad-based, too wide, and we're putting all these people, into this net of, well, you can't own a firearm, when really there is no relation in many of these cases to whether the person ought to be able to own a firearm. But because our federal law is so broad sweeping, and because even a disorderly conduct in Wisconsin, if it's a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, as that term is defined under federal law, can trigger the federal ban on owning a firearm.
And here's the other thing about the controversy that's so disturbing. For if you're knowledgeable about how the law works and how the role of the judiciary properly should apply in that context, what the Supreme Court's doing here is they're struggling with, what did Congress mean when they used these different words? And, you know, I think if you ask your average person on the street, what does violence mean? it's going to be different than what the Supreme Court figures that the legislature meant. Okay, so that's a pretty commonly used word. I think we all have an idea about what violence is.
Right.
Like when you go to a movie and it's rated R because it contains violence,
yeah.
It's not because somebody's, you know, saying, "Did you cheat on me?" And then maybe touching the wife's shoulder and saying, "I need you to be serious about this." And she says, "I'm calling the police."
Yeah, you know, that's offensive. That could be offensive touching.
That could be offensive touching. And by the way, when we say offensive touching, that's kind of a legal term. What it means is some form of contact, and this is what battery is, by the way. You know this, Casey,
yeah.
But our listeners might not. You think battery means, you know, you're whacking the heck out of somebody with a stick or a tire iron or something, or punching them or something like that. No. It means any physical contact that is not consented to by the other person that causes some even minor level of discomfort.
Yeah.
Okay? Not pain, not anything other than just like, gee, I didn't like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And we, you know, that happens a lot. And that's something that can trigger a lifetime ban on possessing
firearms. On your right to own a firearm.
But my point is this. If we go back to, and when the Supreme Court is analyzing stuff, we have this concept in the law that the law speaks for itself. If it's not vague, if it's not something that is not specific enough to put the people on notice as to what is and what isn't against the law, we rely on the natural meaning of words. And the goal of most good legislation is to be clear, to say, this is what we mean, this is what we don't mean. And we try to use words that are plain, that everybody understands, that are not in dispute. Now, if something is so vague that you can't ascertain that concept, the law itself may be unconstitutional because of its vagueness.
Right.
So what the Supreme Court's doing here is using what they perceive to be vagueness and expanding that beyond the natural meaning of words.
Yes.
So now if we're saying, oh, violence is so much more than what you think it is, well, how does that help us as a society apply the law and know what the law is and obey the law?
Right.
That's my problem. I want to obey the law, Casey. I enjoy obeying the law.
You do.
I do.
You do very much.
I take pride in obeying the law. But part of that, the first step, step one out of the two-step process, is knowing what it is.
Absolutely.
And then you follow it. You can't do it the other way around.
And on that note, we have to end the show for the day. Remember, you can listen to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey every Saturday morning from 8 to 9, right here on 1330 WHBL. Have a wonderful weekend.